Sam noticed movement behind Ork. There were people coming down the street, 20 or more kids. Ork noticed it too and glanced behind him.
"They aren't gonna save you,"
Ork said, and swung the bat hard. Sam ducked. The bat whooshed past his head, and Ork rotated halfway around, carried forward by the momentum. Sam was thrown off balance, but Adelio was ready. He let loose a roar and plowed headfirst into Ork. Adelio was maybe half Ork's size, but Ork was knocked off his feet. He sprawled out on the concrete. Chaz went after Adelio, trying to pull him off Ork. The crowd of kids who had come running down the street surged forward. There were angry voices and threats, all aimed at Ork. They yelled, Sam noted, but no one exactly jumped into the unequal fight. A voice cut through all the noise.
"Nobody move," Drake said.
Ork pushed Adelio off and jumped to his feet. He started kicking Adelio, landing size 11 Nike blows into Adelio's defensive arms. Sam jumped in to help his friend, but Drake was quicker. He stepped behind Ork, grabbed him by the hair, yanked his head back, and smashed his elbow into Ork's face. Blood poured from Ork's nose, and he howled in rage. Drake hit him again and released Ork to fall to the concrete.
"Which part of nobody move did you not understand, Ork?" Drake demanded.
Ork rose to his knee and went for Drake like a linebacker. Drake stepped aside, nimble as a matador. He stuck his hand out and said to Chaz,
"Gimme that."
Chaz handed him the bat. Drake hit Ork in the ribs with a short, sharp, forward thrust of the bat. Then again in the kidneys, and again in the side of the head. Each blow was measured, accurate, effective. Ork rolled over onto his back, helpless, exposed. Drake pushed the thick end of the bat against Ork's throat.
"Dude, you really need to learn to listen when I talk."
Then, Drake laughed, stepped back, twirled the bat in the air, caught it, and rested it on his shoulder. He grinned at Sam.
"Now how about you tell me what's going on, Mr. Fire Chief?"
Sam had gone up against bullies before, but he'd never seen anything like Drake Merwin. Ork outweighed Drake by at least 50 pounds, but Drake had handled him like a little toy action figure. Sam pointed at Bet, still cowering. "I think Ork hit her."
"Yeah? So?"
"So I wasn't gonna let him do it again," Sam said, as calmly as he could.
"It didn't look to me like you were getting ready to rescue anyone. Looked to me like you were about to get your head knocked off your shoulders,"
Drake said.
"Bet wasn't doing anything wrong,"
a shrill young voice from the crowd yelled. Without looking back, Drake said,
"Shut up."
He pointed at Chaz.
"You, explain what this is about."
Chaz was an athletic-looking kid with nearly shoulder-length blonde hair and trendy glasses. He was wearing the Coats uniform, dirty and rumpled after many days' use.
"That girl was doing something."
He pointed at Bet.
"She was using a power."
Sam felt a cold chill run up his spine. "The power," he had said. Like it was just something you mentioned in casual conversation. Like it was a common thing everyone knew about. Drake smirked.
"Why, whatever can you possibly mean, Chaz?"
The way he said it was an unmistakable threat.
"Nothing.
Chaz said quickly.
She was doing a magic trick,
a voice yelled.
She wasn't hurting anyone.
I told her to stop.
Ork was on his feet again, glaring with undisguised hatred, but also some wariness at Drake.
Ork is a deputy sheriff, Drake said reasonably. So when he tells someone to stop doing something wrong, they have to stop. If this girl refused to obey, hey, I guess she got what she deserved.
You don't have the right to beat on people, Sam said. Drake had a shark's grin. Too many teeth, too little humor.
Someone has to make people listen to the rules, right?
There are rules against doing magic tricks? Adelio asked.
Yes, Drake said. But I guess some people didn't know that. Chaz, give the fire chief the latest copy of the rules.
Sam accepted a crumpled, folded piece of paper without looking at it.
There you go, Drake said. Now you know the rules.
No one's doing magic around here, Quinn said, placating.
Then my work is done,
Drake said, and laughed at his own wit. He tossed the baseball bat to Chaz.
Okay, everyone go home.
Bet will stay here for a while, Sam said.
Whatever.
Drake drew Ork and the others in his wake. The crowd parted for him. Sam knelt beside Bet.
We're gonna get you bandaged up.
What's this about magic tricks?
Quinn asked her. Bet shook her head.
It was nothing.
She made little balls of light come out of her hands, a young voice said. It was a cool trick.
Okay, you guys heard what Drake said. Everybody out of here, Quinn said in a loud voice. All of you go home.
Sam, Quinn, and Adelio half-carried Bet inside and sat her in the ambulance. Adelio used the sterile wipes to clean the blood from her face, applied an antibiotic cream, and used two butterfly bandages to close the wound.
You can spend the night here, Bet,
Sam said.
No, I have to get home. My brother will need me, Bet said. But thanks.
She managed a smile for Adelio.
I'm sorry I got you kicked.
Adelio shrugged, embarrassed.
No big thing.
Sam left to walk Bet home. Quinn and Adelio trudged back up the stairs. Quinn went to the pot and used the slotted spoon to drain a few pieces of rotini. He tasted one.
It's like mush, man.
Overcooked,
Adelio agreed, looking over his shoulder. Quinn said,
Cheerios?
He poured himself some and began humming to himself, determined not to get into a conversation with Adelio. It was getting so he could barely stand Adelio. His cheerfulness, his competence at just about everything. And just now, the way he had thrown himself against Ork like some kind of Mexican commando. It was stupid, Quinn thought. Stupid going after a guy like Ork. It was too bad what had happened to Bet, but what was the point picking a fight with someone you couldn't beat? If Drake hadn't come along, Adelio would be lucky to be walking right now.
Come to think of it.
Sam returned. He nodded at Adelio and barely looked at Quinn. Quinn gritted his teeth. Perfect. Now Sam was mad at him for not getting his head beat in. Like Sam was such a big hero. Quinn could remember lots of times when Sam had wimped out on waves that Quinn jumped on. Lots of times.
The pasta didn't survive, Quinn said. I got Bet home. I hope she's okay, Sam said. She said she was okay. "Bet's got what you have, doesn't she?" Quinn said, as Sam sat down and dug into his own bowl of cereal. "Yeah. Maybe less of it, I guess. She told me all she can do is make her hands kind of glow."
"So she hasn't burned anyone's arm off yet, huh?"
Quinn was tired of the way Sam was looking at him with a mixture of pity and contempt. He was tired of being dissed just because he had some common sense and minded his own business. Sam looked up, eyes narrowed, like he might make an argument of it. But he pressed his lips into a grim line and pushed his food away and said nothing. Quinn said,
"This is why you can't tell anyone. People will think you're a freak. You see what happens to freaks."
"Bet's not a freak," Sam said, in the forced calm way he had, that gritted teeth thing he did. "She's just a girl from school."
"Don't be stupid, Sam," Quinn said. "Bet, little Pete, the girl in the fire, you? If there's four of you, there's more. Normal people aren't gonna like that. Normal people are gonna think you're dangerous or whatever."
"Is that what you think, Quinn?" Sam asked in a quiet voice. But still, he avoided looking Quinn in the eye. Sam found the rules sheet in his back pocket, unfolded it, and spread it on the table. Quinn said,
"I'm just saying look around, man. Kids have enough to be scared of. How are normal people..."
"You want to stop saying normal people like that?" Sam snapped. Adelio, always the peacemaker now between Sam and Quinn, said,
"Read out those rules, man."
Sam sighed. He flattened the paper carefully, scanned down the page, and made a rude noise. "Number one says Kane is the mayor of Perdido Beach and the whole area known as the Faze." Adelio snorted.
"Doesn't think much of himself, does he?"
"Number two, Drake is appointed sheriff and has the power to enforce the rules. Number three, I'm fire chief and responsible for responding to emergencies."
"Great. Lucky me."
He glanced up and added, "Lucky us."
"Nice of you to remember the little people," Quinn sniped.
"Number four, no one may enter any store and remove anything without permission from the mayor or the sheriff."
Quinn said, "You have a beef with that? People can't be just looting stuff all the time, grabbing whatever."
"No beef with that," Sam agreed reluctantly. "Five says we all have to help Mother Mary at the daycare, provide her with whatever she asks for, and help any time she says."
"Okay, fair enough."
"Six, thou shalt not kill."
"Really?"
Quinn asked. Sam made a wan smile, the way he did when he was tired of being mad and expected everyone else to be tired of it, too.
"Kidding," Sam said. "Okay, stop goofing and just read the thing."
"Just trying to keep a sense of humor while the world's falling apart around us," Sam said.
"Six, we all have to help out on jobs like searching homes or whatever.
Seven, we're all supposed to pass information on any bad behavior to Drake."
"So we're all supposed to be informers," Adelio said.
"Don't worry, there's no immigration cops, no migra," Quinn said. "And anyway, if someone can figure out how to send you back to Mexico, I'll go with you."
"Honduras," Adelio said. "Not Mexico. For like the 10th time."
"Number 8. Here it is. I'll read it like it's written," Sam said. "People will not perform magic tricks or any other action that causes fear or worry."
"What's that mean?" Quinn asked.
"It means Kane obviously knows about the power."
"Big surprise."
Adelio nodded over his bowl of cereal.
"Kid's talking like he was an act of God. I always said Kane had the power. People saying Kane's like a mago. You know, like a magician."
Quinn said, "Nah, man, if he had the power, he wouldn't be having Orc and Drake trying to stop people using it.
Sure he would, Quinn, Sam said, if he wanted to be the only one who had it.
Paranoid much, bruh?
Number 9, Sam continued reading. We are in a state of emergency. During this crisis, no one should criticize, ridicule, or hinder any of the people performing their official duties. Quinn shrugged.
Well, we are having a crisis, right?
If this isn't a crisis, I don't know what would be. So we're suddenly not allowed to say anything? Sam was shaking his head in disbelief.
The moment of attempted reconciliation was over. Sam was back to being disappointed in Quinn.
Look, it's like school, right? Quinn argued. You can't diss the teachers. Not to their faces, anyway.
Then you'll really like number 10, Quinn.
The sheriff may decide that the above rules are insufficient to cover some emergency situations. In those cases, the sheriff may formulate whatever rules are needed to keep order and keep people safe.
Formulate? Quinn snorted. Sounds like Astrid helped them write it.
Sam pushed the paper away.
No, not Astrid's style.
He folded his hands together, placed them on the table, and announced,
"This is wrong."
Adelio's worried look mirrored Sam's.
"Yeah, man, this ain't right. That's saying Kane and Drake can do whatever they want any time they want."
"That's what it comes down to," Sam agreed. "And he's getting people to start suspecting each other, turn against each other."
Quinn laughed. "You don't get it, brah. People are already suspicious. This isn't normal times, okay? We're cut off. We have no adults of any kind, no police or teachers or parents, and no offense, but we have some of us, like, mutating or whatever. You act like you expect everything to just go along like normal, like there is no phase."
Sam was done with his patient act. "And you're acting like you think Bet deserved that beating. Why are you not pissed off, Quinn? Why are you okay with the idea that a girl we know, a girl who never hurt anyone, gets beat down by Orc? Oh, that's where you're going? Like it's my fault?" Quinn stood up and shoved his chair back. "Look, Sam, I'm not saying it's right for her to get beat on, all right? But what do you expect? I mean, kids get picked on for wearing the wrong clothes or sucking at sports or whatever. And that's when there are teachers and parents around. That's just everyday life. You think now, as messed up as everything is, kids are going to be thinking, 'Oh, Sam could shoot firebolts out of his eyeballs or whatever. Okay, that's cool.' No, brah, that's not the way it is."
To Quinn's surprise, and even more to Sam's, Adelio said, "He's right. If there's more people with, you know, like you and Bet, there's going to be trouble. Some folks with the power, some folks without. Me, I'm used to being a second-class citizen."
He shot a dark look at Quinn, which Quinn ignored.
"But other people are going to be jealous, and they're going to get scared, and anyway, they're all weirded out, so they are going to be looking for someone to blame. In Spanish, we say cabeza de turco. It means someone you blame for all your problems."
"Scapegoat," Quinn translated. Adelio nodded.
"Yeah, that's it. A scapegoat."
Quinn spread his hands wide in an expression of aggrieved innocence.
"What have I been saying? That's the way it is. You're different. You get to be a victim. You try and act all superior, Sam, all righteous, but you haven't even figured it out yet. Worst that happened to us back then was we get in trouble, get suspended, get an F or whatever. Screw up now and it's a baseball bat up alongside your head. There were always bullies, but the adults were still in charge. Now? Now the bullies rule. Different game, brother. A whole different game. We play by the bully rules now."
17. 169 hours, 18 minutes.
"I need more pills,"
Cookie cried, in a voice that, to Dara Beidou's dismay, never seemed to weaken or grow hoarse.
"It's too soon,"
Dara said for the millionth time in the last 3 days.
Give me the pills!
Cookie bellowed.
It hurts! It hurts so bad!
Dara pressed her hands over her ears and tried to make sense of the text open in front of her. It would probably have been easy to figure out what to do if she still had the internet. Then she could have opened a Google page and punched in Vicodin and overdose. It was harder to get a straight answer from the thick, dog-eared physician's desk reference someone had brought her from the only doctor's office in Perdido Beach. The problem, among other things, was that she was playing mix and match with everything from Advil to Vicodin to Tylenol with codeine. There was nothing in the book about how to control pain by mixing together a little of this and a little of that, and not enough of anything. Dara's boyfriend, Elwood, was slumped in a chair, passed out. He had been a faithful friend, at least so far as hanging around and keeping her company. And he always helped her lift Cookie up to slide the bedpan under his butt when he needed to go. But there were limits to what her boyfriend would do. He wouldn't clean out the bedpan. He wouldn't hold the funnel when the boy needed to pee. Dara had done that. In the 3 days since she had accidentally become the person responsible for this squalid, dark, windowless, joyless subterranean kingdom of misery beneath the church, Dara had done all sorts of things she never thought she could do. Things she sure didn't want to do, including giving a diabetic 7-year-old daily insulin injections. There was a knock at the door, and Dara swiveled her chair away from the desk and the circle of light that spilled over the almost useless book. Mary Terrafino was there, with a girl who looked like she was maybe 4.
"Hi, Mary,"
Dara said.
"What do we have here?"
"I'm sorry to bother you," Mary said. "I know how busy you are, but she has some kind of pain in her stomach."
The two girls hugged. They hadn't known each other well before the phase, but now they were like sisters. Dara knelt down to eye level with the little girl.
"Hi, honey. What's your name?"
"Ashley."
"Okay, Ashley. Let's get your temperature and see what's going on. Can you come over and sit on the table?"
Dara slid the electronic thermometer into a fresh plastic cover and popped the thermometer into the little girl's mouth.
"You have the moves down,"
Mary said, and smiled. Cookie bellowed suddenly, so loudly and so obscenely that Ashley almost swallowed the thermometer.
"I'm running out of pain pills,"
Dara said.
"I don't know what to do. We've emptied out the doctor's office, and sometimes we get some meds that people have found when they're doing house searches. But he's in so much pain."
"Is it getting any better? His shoulder, I mean?"
"No,"
Dara said.
"It's not going to get better. All I can do is keep it clean."
She examined the thermometer.
98.9. That's well within the normal range. Lie back and let me check something. I'm going to push on your tummy. It might tickle a little."
"Are you going to give me a shot?"
the little girl asked.
"No, honey. I just want to push on your tummy."
Dara pressed down with her fingertips, pressed the girl's belly pretty far down, and then released suddenly.
"Did that hurt?"
"It tickled."
"What are you checking for?"
Mary asked.
"Appendicitis."
Dara shrugged.
"It's about all I know, Mary. When I look up stomach pain, I get everything from constipation to stomach cancer. Probably she needs to poop."
To the little girl, she said,
"Have you pooped today?"
"I don't think so."
"I'll sit her on the toilet,"
Mary said.
"Make her drink some water. You know, like a couple of cups."
Mary squeezed her hand.
"I know you're not a doctor, but it's good to have you."
Dara sighed.
I'm trying to read that book, but mostly all it does is scare me. I mean, there are a million diseases I've never even heard of, and I don't want to even think about.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mary was stalling. Dara asked her if there was something else.
Listen, I know this is weird and all,
Mary said, lowering her voice to a confidential level.
But anything I tell you,
I don't talk to anyone about what goes on here,
Dara said, a little stiffly.
I know. Sorry. It's not... I mean, it's something embarrassing.
Mary, I am so past embarrassing. I am way into humiliating and disgusting now, so nothing you tell me is going to bother me.
Mary nodded. She twisted her fingers together and said, in a rush,
Look, I take Prozac.
What for?
Just some, you know, some issues. The thing is, I ran out. I know it's not as important as a lot of what you're doing.
She glanced at Cookie.
It's just, when I don't have the pills, I get...
She sucked in sharply and let go of a sigh that was almost a sob.
No problem,
Dara said. She wanted to push for further information, but instinct told her to drop it.
Let me see what I have. Do you know what strength of pill you take?
40 milligrams, once a day.
I have to pee,
Cookie moaned pitiably. Dara went to the cupboard where she kept the medications. Some were in large, white pharmacy bottles, some in smaller, brown twist-top bottles, and she had some sample packs taken from the doctor's office. Elwood woke up with a snort.
Oh, man, I fell asleep.
Hi, Elwood,
Mary said.
Uh-huh,
Elwood said, and rested his head on his hand and fell back to sleep.
He's nice to stay with you,
Mary said.
He's useless,
Dara said sharply. But then she relented.
But at least he's here. I guess I can give you some 20-milligram pills and let you take two.
She tapped the capsules into her palm.
Here's enough for a week. Sorry, I don't have a bottle or anything.
Mary took the pills gratefully.
You're a good person, Dara. When this is all over someday, you know, when we grow up, you can become a doctor.
Dara laughed bitterly.
After this, Mary, that's the last thing I'd want to be.
The doors of the hospital pushed in suddenly. Both girls turned sharply to see bouncing Bet. She staggered in with her right hand pressed against her head.
My head hurts,
Bet said. She was barely comprehensible. She spoke with noticeable slurring. Her left arm seemed to be lifeless, hanging limp by her side. Her left leg trailed as she took several steps closer. Dara ran to catch her as Bet collapsed.
Elwood, wake up!
Dara yelled. Dara, Elwood, and Mary half-dragged, half-carried Bet to the bed where Ashley had been examined.
I have to poop now,
Ashley said.
Oh, God! I need some more pills!
Cookie howled.
Shut up!
Dara shouted. She put her hands over her ears and squeezed her eyes shut.
Everyone, shut up!
Bet was on the table now, whispering,
I'm sorry.
It came out,
M'shwee.
I didn't mean you, Bet,
Dara apologized.
Just lie back.
Dara looked at her face and said to Elwood,
Get the book.
She propped the physician's desk reference open on Bet's stomach and began thumbing quickly through the index.
My head hurt,
Bet said. She raised her good arm to touch the bloody lump on the side of her head. "Did someone hit you, Bet?" Elwood asked. Bet seemed confused by the question. She frowned, as if the question made no sense. She moaned in pain. "One side of her body isn't working right," Dara said. "Look at the way her mouth is drooping. And her eyes. They don't match."
"My head hurt bad,"
Bet moaned.
"I think she's saying her head hurts," Mary said.
"What do we do?"
"I don't know. How about if I just cut open her head and see if I can fix it?"
Dara was shrill.
"Then I'll just do some quick surgery on Cookie. No problem. I mean, I have this stupid book."
She snatched the book up and threw it across the room. It skidded across the polished linoleum floor. Dara tried taking several deep breaths. The little girl Ashley was crying. Mary was looking at Dara like she had lost her mind. Cookie was alternating between crying for pills and crying that he needed to pee.
"Tecumseh,"
Bet said. She grabbed Mary's arm.
"Melba."
Bet's face contorted in pain. And then her features relaxed.
"Bet," Dara said. "Bet. Don't do this, Bet. Bet,"
Dara whispered. She placed two fingers against Bet's throat.
"What did she say?"
Elwood asked. Mary answered,
"I think she was asking us to take care of her brother."
Dara lifted her fingers from Bet's neck. She stroked the girl's face once, a lingering goodbye.
"Is she..."
Mary couldn't finish the question.
"Yes,"
Dara whispered.
"There was probably bleeding inside her head, not just outside. Whoever hit her in the head killed her."
"Elwood, go find Adelio at the firehouse.
Tell him we have to bury Bet. She's with God now,"
Mary said.
"I'm not sure there is a God in the face,"
Dara said. They buried Bet next to the fire starter in the plaza at 1 o'clock in the morning. There was no place to keep dead bodies, and no way to prepare the bodies for the grave. Adelio dug the hole with his backhoe. The sound of it, the straining of the engine, the sudden jerks of the shovel, seemed horribly loud and horribly out of place. Sam was there, along with Astrid and little Pete. Mary, Albert, who came over from the McDonald's, Elwood, standing in for Dara, who had to stay with Cookie, and the twins, Anna and Emma. Bet's little brother was there, too, 9 years old, sobbing with Mary's arm around him. Quinn opted not to attend. Sam and Adelio had carried Bet's body the few dozen feet from the church basement to the plaza. They couldn't figure out a gentle or dignified way to lower Bet into the hole, so in the end, they just rolled her in. She made a sound like a dropped backpack.
"We should say something,"
Anna suggested.
"Maybe things we remember about Bet."
So they did, telling what few stories they could remember. None of them had been close friends of hers. Astrid began the Lord's Prayer.
"Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name."
Little Pete said it along with her. More words than anyone had ever heard him speak. The others, all but Sam, joined in. Then they each shoveled a spadeful of dirt over her and stood back while Adelio used the backhoe to finish the job.
I'll make her a cross tomorrow, Adelio said when he was finished. As the ceremony was breaking up, Ork and Howard appeared, ghosts in the mist, watching. No one spoke to them. They left after a few minutes. I shouldn't have let her go home, Sam said to Astrid.
You're not a doctor. There was no way you could know she had internal bleeding. And anyway, what could you have done? The question is, what are we going to do now?
What do you want to do? Sam asked.
Ork murdered Bet, Astrid said flatly. Maybe he didn't mean to, but it's still murder.
Yes. He killed her. So what do you want to do?
At least we can demand that something be done to Ork.
Demand of who? Sam said. He zipped his jacket. It was chilly. You want to go demand justice from Cain?
Rhetorical question,
Astrid commented. Does that mean it's a question I don't expect you to be able to answer? Astrid nodded. Neither of them had anything to say for a while. Mary and the twins, with Bet's little brother in tow, headed back to the daycare. Elwood said, speaking to no one in particular,
I don't know if Dara can keep this up much longer.
Then he squared his shoulders and marched back toward the hospital. Adelio came and stood with Sam and Astrid.
This can't just be something that happened, he said. You hear me? We let this go. Where does it stop? People can't be beating each other up so bad they die.
You have a suggestion? Sam asked coldly.
Me? I'm the wetback, remember? I'm not from around here. I don't even know these people. I'm not the big genius, and I'm not the one with this power thing, man.
He kicked at the dirt, hard, like it was someone he wanted to hurt. He seemed like he might say more, but he bit his lip, spun, and strode away. Sam said, Cain has Drake and Ork, Panda and Chaz, and I hear Mallet has made peace with him. And maybe a half dozen other guys.
Are you afraid of them?
Astrid asked him.
Yeah, Astrid, I am. Okay,
she said.
But you were scared of going into a burning building, too.
You don't get this, do you?
Sam demanded, with enough heat that Astrid took a step back.
I know what you want, okay? I know what you and a bunch of other people want. You want me to be the anti-Cain. You don't like the way he's doing things, and you want me to go kick him out.
Well, here's what you don't know. Even if I could do all that, I wouldn't be any better than him. You're wrong about that, Sam. You're...
That night when I first used the power? When I hurt my stepfather? How do you think I felt?
Sad. Regretful.
Astrid looked at his face like the answer would be written there.
Scared, probably.
Yeah. All that.
And one more thing. He held up his hand and inches from her nose, squeezed his fingers into a tight fist.
I also felt a rush, Astrid. A rush. I thought, oh my God, look at the power I have. Look what I can do. A huge, crazy rush. Power corrupts,
Astrid said softly. Yeah, Sam said sarcastically. I've heard that.
Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I forget who said it. I make a lot of mistakes, Astrid. I don't want to make that mistake. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be Cain. I want to...
He spread his arms wide, a gesture of helplessness.
I just want to go surfing. You won't be corrupted, Sam. You won't do those things.
He had moved back. She moved to close the distance.
How can you be so sure?
Well, two reasons. First, it's not your character. Of course you felt a rush from the power. Then you pushed it away. You didn't grab at it, you pushed it away. That's reason number one. You're you. You're not Cain or Drake or Ork.
Sam wanted to agree, wanted to accept that, but he felt he knew better. Don't be so sure.
And reason number two. You have me,
Astrid said.
Do I?
Yes.
That drained the anger and frustration from him like someone had pulled a plug. For a long moment, he was lost, gazing into her eyes. She was very close. His heart shifted to a deeper rhythm that vibrated his whole body. There were just inches between them. He closed the distance by half. Stopped.
I can't kiss you with your little brother watching,
he said. Astrid stepped back, took little Pete by the shoulders, and turned him so he was facing away.
How about now?
18. 164 hours, 32 minutes. Albert left the funeral ceremony and crossed the plaza toward the McDonald's. He wished he had someone to talk to. Maybe if he flipped the lights on, someone would come in for a very late burger. But the small crowd dispersed before he could unlock the front door of the McDonald's, his McDonald's, and the plaza was left empty and silent but for a faint hum from power lines overhead. Albert stood with his keys in one hand and his McDonald's issue cap in his other hand. He had taken it off out of respect for the dead, and let a sense of gloom and foreboding wash over him. He was a naturally optimistic person, but a nighttime funeral of a young girl murdered by bullies, that wasn't something that exactly perked up your mood. Albert had enjoyed being alone since the fall of the phase. He worried about his brothers and sisters. He missed his mom. But he had gone in an instant from being the youngest of six, the goat, the victim, the overworked and underappreciated youngster, to being a responsible and respected person in this strange new community. None of which changed the fact that, right now, with the smell of fresh-turned earth in his nostrils and disquiet boring holes in his brain, he would have loved to be watching one of his mother's favorite gruesome crime shows and sneaking popcorn out of the bowl on her lap. The big issues in the phase, the what and the why and the how, didn't bother Albert much. He was a practical person, and anyway, those were things for someone like Astrid to ponder. As for the events of this night, the killing of Bet, that was for Sam and Cain and those guys to work out. What had Albert worried was something entirely different. No one was working. No one but Mary and Dara and occasionally Adelio. Everyone else was moping or wandering or fighting, or else just sitting around and playing video games or watching DVDs. They were all like rats living in an abandoned house. They ate what they found, messed wherever they liked, and left things dirtier and more run down than they found them. It couldn't last. Everyone was just killing time. But if all they did was kill time, time would end up killing them. Albert believed that, knew that, but he couldn't explain it to anyone and make them listen. He couldn't talk with the smooth assurance of a Cain or the knowing detachment of an Astrid. When Albert spoke, people didn't pay attention the way they did to Sam. He needed someone else's words to explain what his instincts told him must be true. Albert dropped his keys into his pocket and marched up the street with a determined stride that echoed off dark storefronts. The smart thing to do would be to head home, get a few hours of sleep. It would be dawn soon. But he wasn't going to sleep. He knew that. Sam and Kane and Astrid and Computer Jack all had their things they did, their things they knew. But this was Albert's.
"We can't be rats,"
he muttered to himself.
"We have to be..."
But even trying to explain it to himself, he didn't know the right words. The county library branch in Perdido Beach wasn't an impressive place. It was a dusty, gloomy, low-ceilinged storefront that hit him with a whiff of mildew when he swung the door open. He had never entered the place before, and was a little surprised to find it unlocked with the overhead fluorescent tubes still flickering and buzzing. Albert looked around and laughed.
"No one's been here since the phase,"
he said to a rack of yellowed paperbacks. He looked in the librarian's old oaken desk. You never knew where a candy bar might be hiding. He found a can of peppermints. They looked like they'd been there quite a while, treats to be handed out to kids who never came. He popped one in his mouth and began to walk the meager stacks. He knew he needed to know something, but he didn't know what he needed to know. Most of the books looked like they'd been there undisturbed since before Albert was born. He found a set of encyclopedias, like Wikipedia, but paper and very bulky. He plopped down on the ratty carpet and opened the first book. He didn't know what he was looking for, but he knew where to start. He slid out the volume for W and turned to the entry for work. There were two main entries. One had to do with work in terms of physics. The other entry talked about work as the activities necessary for the survival of society.
"Yeah,"
Albert said.
"That's what I'm talking about."
He started reading. He jumped from volume to volume, understanding only part of what he was reading, but understanding enough to follow another lead, and then another. It was exactly like following hyperlinks, only slower and with more lifting. Work led to labor, which led him to productivity, which led to someone named Karl Marx, which led to another old guy named Adam Smith. Albert had never been much of a serious student, but what he had learned in school had never mattered much from his point of view. This mattered. Everything mattered now. Albert drifted slowly off to sleep and woke up with a start, feeling eyes watching him. He spun around, jumped to his feet, and heaved a huge sigh of relief when he saw that it was just a cat. The cat was a yellow tabby, a little fat, probably old. It had a pink collar and heart-shaped brass tag. It stood with perfect confidence and self-possession in the middle of the aisle. The cat stared at him from green eyes. Its tail twitched.
"Hi, kitty,"
Albert said. The cat disappeared. Gone. Albert recoiled in shock, his face suddenly ablaze with pain. The cat was on him, on his face, digging razor claws into his head. The cat hissed, needle teeth exposed by a fierce scowl a millimeter from Albert's eyes. Albert yelled for help, yelled at the cat. The cat dug its claws deeper. Albert still had a volume of the encyclopedia in his right hand, the S-book. He slammed it down on his own head. The cat was gone. The book knocked Albert silly. And now the cat was clear across the room, sitting calmly atop the librarian's desk. It was impossible. Nothing moved that fast. Nothing. Albert drew a shaky breath and began backing toward the door to the street. Without any movement that Albert's eyes could detect, the cat went from the desk to the back of Albert's neck. It was on him like a mad thing, clawing, scratching, tearing, hissing. Again, Albert swung the heavy book, and again the blow landed on his own flesh, because now the cat was perched atop a stack, peering down at Albert, mocking him with cool, green-eyed contempt. It was going to attack him again. Instinct made Albert swing the book up to protect his face. He felt the book jump violently in his hands. The cat's face, distorted by rage, was an inch from Albert's own face. But the book was still in place. And the cat was in the book. No, through the book. Albert stared in shock as the cat's eyes darkened and its animal soul fled. He dropped the encyclopedia on the floor. The book, the heavy, blue, leather-bound volume, bisected the cat just behind the front paws. It was as if someone had cut the cat in half and sewed it in two pieces to the book. The back of the cat stuck out from the back cover. Albert was panting, as much from terror as exertion. The thing on the floor, that thing wasn't possible. The way the cat had moved, not possible.
"Nightmare. You're having a nightmare," he told himself.
But if it was a dream, it was a dream with a lot of the texture of reality. Surely he wouldn't dream the smell of mildew. Surely he wouldn't dream the way the cat's bladder and bowels emptied messily in death. Albert remembered seeing the librarian's large shoulder bag at her desk. With shaking hands, he emptied the contents out onto the desk. Lipstick, wallet, compact, a cell phone, all scattered. He picked up the encyclopedia. It was heavy. The weight of the cat added to the book had to be 20 pounds, and the cat in the book was bulky, too big to fit easily into the bag. But he had to show this to someone. This was an impossible thing. Impossible. Except that it was real. Albert needed someone else to tell him that it was real, someone to confirm that he wasn't dreaming or crazy. Not Kane. Sam? He would be at the firehouse, but this wasn't a Sam thing. It was an Astrid thing. 2 minutes later, he was on Astrid's well-lit stoop. Astrid opened her door cautiously and only after checking the peephole.
"Albert? It's the middle of the... Oh my God, what happened to your face?"
"I could use some band-aids," Albert said.
He'd forgotten what he must look like. He'd forgotten the pain.
"Yeah, I could use some help, but that's not why I came here."
"Then..."
"Astrid, I need..."
His words failed him then. Now safe in Astrid's entryway, the fear took hold, and for a minute he just could not form a word or make a sound. Astrid drew him inside and closed the door.
"I need..."
he began again, and again couldn't say more. In a strangled voice, he said,
"Just look."
He dumped the cat and the book onto the oriental rug. Astrid went completely still.
"It was so fast. It attacked me. I couldn't even see it move. It was like it was in one place, right? And then it was on me. I mean, it didn't jump, Astrid. It just... appeared."
Astrid knelt to push gingerly at the book. She tried to make the book fall open, but the body of the cat went through each page and held them together. Not like the cat had made a hole, like the cat had fused together with the paper.
"What is it, Astrid?"
Albert pleaded. She said nothing, just stared. Albert could all but see the wheels turning in her brain, but she gave him no answer, and Albert accepted after a while that no answer would be forthcoming. No explanation was possible for a thing that could not be. But she had seen the thing, the impossible thing. He wasn't crazy. After what felt like a very long time, Astrid whispered,
"Come on, Albert. Let's do something with those scratches."
Lana lay in the dark in the cabin, listening to the mysterious sounds of the desert outside. Something made a soft, slithery sound, like a hand stroking silk. Something else emitted rapid, percussive bursts, a tiny insect drummer who slowed after a few seconds and lost his way and fell silent before starting all over again. The windmill squeaked infuriatingly. Never for long, never in any kind of pattern. There was no real breeze, just whispers that turned the weathered wooden blades a quarter turn, squeak, or a half turn, squeak, squeak, or barely nudged them to produce a sound like the shrill peep of a baby bird. Against all that was the reassuring snore from Patrick. He would snore and stop and snore again, and every now and then give up a low yipping sound that Lana found endearing. Lana's body was well. Her injuries were all miraculously healed. She had washed away the caked-on blood. She had water and food and shelter. But Lana's brain was an engine revved to breakneck speed. It turned over and over, swirling through memories of pain, memories of terror, flashes of her grandfather's empty seat, the tumble down the slope, the buzzards, the lion. But as lurid as all those images were, they were just fresh paint splashed on more permanent images. The pictures that lingered were of home, school, the mall, her dad's car and her mom's van, the community pool, the sizzling fantasy skyline of the Las Vegas Strip visible from her bedroom window. Taken all together, the pictures churning and churning in her head fed a constant slow burn of rage. She should be home, not here. She should be in her room. She should be with her friends. Not alone. Not alone listening to eerie noises and a squeak and a snore. If she had been a little more careful. She had tried to stuff the bottle of vodka into her shoulder bag, the cute one with the beadwork she liked. The bag was too small, but the only bag big enough was her book bag, and she hadn't wanted to carry it because it didn't work with her outfit. For that, she had been caught. For a stupid question of fashion, of looking cool. And now, a tidal wave of fury at her mother swept across her. It felt like she would drown in all that rage. Her mother, that's who she blamed. Her father just did what her mom told him to do. He had to back her up, even though he was the nicer one, not as strict or as snipey as her mother. What was the big deal if she gave Tony a bottle of vodka? It's not like he was driving a car. Lana's mother just didn't understand Las Vegas. Vegas wasn't Perdido Beach. There were pressures on her in Las Vegas. It was a city, not a town. and not just any city. Kids grew up faster in Vegas. Demands were made, even of seventh graders, eighth graders, let alone a ninth grader like her. Her stupid mother. Her fault. Although it was kind of hard to blame her mother for the blank, intimidating wall in the desert. Kind of hard to blame her for that. Maybe it was aliens, and right now some creepy monsters were chasing her mother and father through the streets of Las Vegas, like in that movie War of the Worlds. Maybe. Lana found that thought strangely comforting. After all, at least she wasn't being chased by aliens in giant tripods. Maybe the wall was some kind of defense put up against the aliens. Maybe she was safe on this side of the wall. The bottle of vodka wasn't the only time she'd snuck something for Tony. Lana had palmed some of her mother's Xanax for him, and she had shoplifted a bottle of wine once from a convenience store. She wasn't naive. She never thought Tony loved her or anything. She knew he was using her. But she was using him, too, in her own way. Tony had some status in the school, and some of that had been transferred to her. Patrick snorted and raised his head very suddenly.
"What is it, boy?"
She rolled from the narrow cot and crouched, silent and fearful, in the dark cabin. Something was outside. She could hear it moving. Faint sounds of padded feet on the ground. Patrick stood up, but in a strange, slow-motion way. His hackles were raised, the fur on his back bristling. He was staring intently at the doorway. There was a scratching sound, exactly like a dog might make trying to get inside. And then Lana heard, or thought she heard, a garbled whisper.
"Come out."
Patrick should be barking, but he wasn't. He was rigid, panting too hard, staring too fixedly.
"You're just imagining things,"
Lana whispered, trying to reassure herself.
"Come out,"
the gravelly whisper called again. Lana discovered that she had to pee. Had to go very badly, and there was nothing like a bathroom in the cabin.
"Is someone there?"
she cried. No answer. Maybe it had just been her imagination. Maybe it was just the wind. She crept to the door and listened intently. Nothing. She glanced at Patrick. Her dog was still bristling, but he had relaxed a bit. The threat, whatever it had been, had moved away. Lana opened the door a crack. Nothing. Nothing she could see anyway. And Patrick was definitely no longer worried. She had no choice. She had to run to the outhouse. Patrick bounded along beside her. The outhouse was a simple, vertical box, undecorated, unadorned, not overly smelly, and quite clean. There was no light, of course, so she had to feel her way around, locate the seat and the toilet paper. At one point, she started giggling. It was, after all, a little funny, peeing in an outhouse while her dog stood guard. The walk back to the shack was a bit more leisurely. Lana took a moment to gaze up at the night sky. The moon was already descending toward the western horizon. The stars... well, the stars looked odd, but she wasn't quite sure why she thought so. She resumed the walk back to the cabin